Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with The Forum at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We've been taking your questions to the experts. The whole discussion series is featured on our Facebook page. But we also wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. Recently, I moderated a forum on the global crisis, how vaccines, emerging variants, and disparities in wealth and resources are influencing the course of the pandemic. Joining the discussion was an all-star panel that included Barry Bloom, the Joan L. and Julius A. Jacobson Research Professor of Public Health and former Dean of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Nina Schwalbe, CEO of Spark Street Advisors, a think tank that's provided support to the World Health Organization and other agencies during the pandemic. She's also an adjunct assistant professor at the Columbia Mailman School of Public Health. Derek Sim is director of vaccine supply and demand at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. And Michael Minna, assistant professor of epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and a core member of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics. So we're all here for this discussion because so much is happening in this moment. More than 2.3 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses have now been administered. That's quite a lot, according to the New York Times tracker. But when you think about it and look at how this has been distributed, it's been so unequal. The lion's share of those doses have gone to wealthier countries and regions. According to UNICEF, less than 1% of vaccines have been given out in low-income countries. And what that means is that the United States is lifting restrictions, returning to some semblance of normal. But around the world, the virus continues to surge, such as across Latin America and in parts of Africa and Asia. G7 nations also recently pledged to donate 1 billion shots. Lots of questions have come up as a result of this. Is that feasible? Is this enough? How will those vaccines be prioritized and distributed? And today we're going to have an opportunity to take on these questions and so much more. To begin, I want to play a clip about the situation in India, where the pandemic has been especially devastating. The country faces ongoing challenges in reaching remote areas of the countryside. And this clip is shown courtesy of Reuters.
The rugged and unforgiving landscapes of Jammu and Kashmir, now vaccination hubs. Wearing protective suits, health workers and administrative officials climbed the steep hills to reach nomads in remote areas on Sunday as India continues to ramp up its inoculation campaign. But it's a mammoth task. Less than 5% of 950 million adult Indians have received the mandatory 2 vaccine doses. This village is not accessible by any kind of vehicle.
For the first time, a team of doctors has come to us nomads. We're very thankful to them for vaccinating us all.
The landscape is a world away from the megacities which reopened for business on Monday, with long queues for buses in the financial hub of Mumbai, while traffic returned to the roads of New Delhi after the devastating second wave. Infections have now hit a 2-month low, allowing authorities to reopen parts of the economy. Prime Minister Narendra Modi said on Monday that the Indian federal government would provide vaccines free of charge to all adults from later this month.
Barry, we just saw one example of the challenges faced in reaching some populations. Can you tell us more about the challenges of getting vaccines to people, especially when we have these persisting massive inequities between wealthy and less wealthy countries?
So thank you, and it's a privilege to be on this wonderful panel. The focus is how do we get vaccines to low and middle income countries? And let me begin by saying what's extraordinary is the effectiveness of all the vaccines that have been thus far licensed. If we look at countries that have the broadest experience, the US, the UK, Israel, they have not only protected people getting really sick and hospitalized and dying, they've also limited transmission. They've done the best of what we would want vaccines to do. So the problem is, how do we get more vaccines to more people in poor countries? And the initial thought was, if we opened up patents. Any country could build a vaccine factory and make vaccines. And it turns out that's really not true. Vaccines are an enormously complex enterprise. Every step of the way has to be measured for safety. The vaccines go into healthy people, and the principle of medicine is to do no harm. So we cannot take chances on vaccines that are not quality controlled at every level. Second, I would love to see vaccine producers in many other countries, but I understand that the cost for that is very high. We have to, for every type of vaccine, build a new factory. And that can range from $500 million to $1 billion. To run that factory, you need specialized equipment for which there is already competition and the supply chains are already tight. Third, you have to have a level of scientific and technical expertise to assure that at every step and in every batch, everything is tested and certain, made certain that the vaccine that comes out of that batch is as safe as could possibly be. And once you make a vaccine, if you were to get such a factory, you need a cold chain to be able to keep it at the temperatures, as in the case of Pfizer, at very cold temperatures. How do you do that in sub-Saharan Africa? How does one think about that? And then it seems to me, finally, what one needs to think about is, are there ways of partnering with the major vaccine companies that do know how to make hundreds of millions of doses, that have patent rights, but in an agreement, if there were such, to help build facilities in Africa and parts of Asia, the expertise could be trained, the technical mechanisms for production could be learned, and there would be a possibility over a period of time of upgrading the scientific capability so these countries would have the facilities and the technical expertise to make good quality vaccines. And finally, I have to say, you can't just make vaccines in Africa. You need an FDA, you need a regulatory authority, you need an outfit that will check on every step of production to be sure that what is said to be done is done. And we've seen that at Emergent in the United States, where two vaccines got confounded and 60 million doses or more have to be thrown out. That requires not building factories, but a regulatory and scientific capability that I certainly would love to see the major companies invest in.
Thank you, Barry. And of course, that affects vaccine access and rollout around the world, including places like South Africa as well, in particular, comes to mind with that example. Nina, I want to go to you. You've worked on a range of public and private public and private nonprofit groups during the pandemic as head of Spark Street Advisors. You're also the immediate past chair of the Evaluation Advisory Committee for Gavi. So building on some of what Barry's talked about, what do you see as the biggest barriers to vaccine access in low income countries? What's your take on this?
Great, thanks, Alana. And thanks for the invitation to join this panel, to Christina, Lisa, and Kristen for the organization, to the Chan School of Health. I'm really honored to be with you today. So when thinking about access to medicines and vaccines, we normally consider four different components of that: affordability, availability, accessibility, and acceptability. And unfortunately, all of these are proving a challenge to access for low and middle-income countries when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines. You know, affordability is clearly a significant issue. And one of the ways we saw that is that it required firm commitments or prepayments in order to sort of reserve doses from manufacturers. There's been inadequate financing for that, as I'm sure Derek will talk to. But there are other things to think about. Perhaps had the price of these vaccines been cheaper, we could have bought more doses, or more cash available, we could have reserved more for early deployment to low and middle income countries. The second issue is really around availability and the supply constraints. And we need to remember this is a new disease. And while the development timelines were absolutely Herculean and new suppliers are coming on board at unprecedented speed, and we'll see the Novavax announcement that, some of my colleagues will talk to a little bit later in this hour. And Barry just mentioned producing vaccines at scale is not easy. Again, the contamination in the Baltimore plant was a great example of that. And then we also had other issues affecting supply. For example, you know, the government of India experienced a huge surge in domestic cases and as a result decided to restrict exports. And as many of you know, Indian manufacturers produce the lion's share, billions of, vaccines each year globally and deliver those to, countries around the world. Third is acceptability. Acceptability refers to a range of supply and demand side challenges, whether the products are the right ones for the countries that are using them. But on the demand side, this is also about confidence and a lack of confidence both in the vaccines themselves and the systems that people that deliver them. Unfortunately, in many countries, we have doses that are going unused. And finally, there are issues around accessibility, in particular for those that are most structurally marginalized, and unfortunately, those most at risk of severe COVID. There's too little focus still on micro-level distribution plans, working with communities to make sure that the most vulnerable get vaccinated. And despite the fact that COVID and COVAX requires countries to report on who receives the vaccination, there's almost nothing in the public domain about whether the doses are actually going to those most at risk. And parenthetically, there's a group called Gender 50-50, and they reported recently that only 39 countries in the world are reporting sex disaggregated data on who's getting the vaccines. And we also heard, you know, quite a lot of anecdotes that in most countries, including our own, the wealthiest were the first to get the shots. These issues, as I said, are not unique to low and middle income countries. I don't know what's happening in Massachusetts. We certainly had the same problems in New York City. And yet we know as public health community, there are evidence ways to address these that go beyond discussions, which have been very heavy on fridge capacity and cold chain capacity. And these are community engagement, micro planning with communities, deploying mobile clinics, offering paid time off work, childcare. There are a number of solutions on accessibility. So while the media has focused on issues like intellectual property barriers, dose sharing, I think we really need to double down on both acceptability and accessibility with a focus first and foremost on those who are most at risk. We are not all at equal risk of dying from COVID. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nina. It's so complicated as you've just outlined, and I look forward to digging in more into a lot of the themes that both you and Barry have brought up. Before we move on to Derek and Michael, I wanted to just bring in an audiogram that was prepared by my colleagues at The World. You'll be hearing the voice of Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, director with the National Institutes of Health, about the need for continued vigilance, even as some countries are doing better. So how this connects throughout the world.
As long as there's disease elsewhere in other countries where you have viral dynamics that continue to allow transmission at a high degree in different countries, there's always not only the difficult time for the countries in question, but also the generation of variants, which can then come back. And even in a country that has the outbreak under very good control, it can actually set you back if you do get a variant that's not really covered very well by a vaccine.
So I want to move now to Derek. We just heard from Dr. Fauci about how even countries that are doing a better job at controlling COVID-19 within their borders should be thinking about these outbreaks and worried about them elsewhere. Can you talk about your work at Gavi, how you're trying to address some of these obstacles to equitable vaccine distribution and the challenges that Nina and Barry just spoke about?
Thanks, Elena. Yeah, indeed. You know, there are a number of different challenges around access. And, you know, the COVAX facility was developed and conceptualized by a number of global health partner organizations. So WHO, Gavi, and CEPI, and UNICEF. And the objective was to ensure that there would be a global pool procurement mechanism for COVID-19 vaccines, through which then fair and equitable access to vaccines would be available for a large number of participating economies And indeed, since its launch in June last year, so just over 12 months now, we had 190 participating economies, join COVAX, which has been really encouraging as it demonstrated a belief in the need for fair and equitable distribution. To date, Gavi is leading on the procurement and the agreements with vaccine manufacturers, as well as design and implementation of the facility. There is also a financing mechanism working with donor governments and donor organizations to ensure that the 92 most vulnerable and least developed economies would be able to access vaccines through subsidized means, which I think is extremely important. To date, we have shipped 88 million vaccines to 31 participating economies. And COVAX has secured agreements for up to 3.8 billion doses of vaccines, including 2.8 billion in agreements with manufacturers, and 1 billion doses through R&D partnerships, from which we hope to eventually benefit from the success of those R&D partnerships. So all in all, we believe it's an encouraging start and certainly a very important step in ensuring global equitable access to these vaccines. As Dr. Fauci said, I think it's important that we don't forget that although certain countries have vaccinated a large proportion of their citizens, that in and of itself is insufficient to fully control the pandemic. And we have seen that recently, even countries which have achieved high levels of vaccination coverage continue to have to use other interventions such as border controls, quarantine, et cetera, in order to fully, you know, manage and mitigate the potential effects of this pandemic on their societies, even though vaccination has been achieved to a fairly high coverage. So it is clear that no one is completely safe until everyone is safe as such, and that equitable access to vaccines for all economies and communities is vitally important in order to achieve, you know, global but even national control of the pandemic. And this is what we, you know, hope to be able to achieve through mechanisms of equitable access, such as the ones that Gavi and COVAX are leading on.
Thank you for that, Derek. And again, COVAX is this initiative to, as you were saying, distribute vaccines globally and equitably around the world. I want to move, Michael, to you in terms of kind of drilling into the idea of these variants and the vaccine access challenges that we're facing or inequities. What is happening with the variants and what does that mean for the supply?
And the variants are, in my opinion, and I think many people's opinion, one of the greatest concerns. They have mutations are what viruses do. So on the one hand, we shouldn't just be afraid of variants because they're variants. That's very, very normal. But as part of viruses' development across populations, they continue to try to, it's this constant battle between immunity and interventions that humans might throw at these viruses and the virus's innate evolutionary drive to continue replicating. And so one of the greatest tools that a virus has at its disposal is random mutations in enough people and in enough viruses within people to try to find a new escape route away from immunity. And while we have seen for the most part that the vaccines have remained quite effective against all of the known variants to date, we also do additionally see that the vaccines do lose some level of efficacy against some of the new variants, in particular things like the Delta variant. We've seen this new naming scheme to help people communicate about the variants. And that is something that I think we need to be paying extraordinary attention to. These different variants do have the potential one day to potentially mutate away from immunity enough so that they can start causing harm to individuals again. I want to emphasize that right now, the vaccines are working, or even with the variants, they're still exceeding all of our pre-existing expectations for how well the vaccines would potentially work. So we're in good shape still. But it goes to this discussion of what is, where the onus is, what level of attention and resources we need to be paying to global transmission. We have a few countries that have the bulk of the world's wealth, you know, that have at the moment a bulk of the world's vaccines. And that is largely because we're ethnocentric, or we want to take care of our own first before helping the rest of the world. And I'm not a bioethicist, and I can't comment on whether that's right or wrong. I could comment on it, but I won't right now. But I think at the very least, what we can start doing is we can start looking at global transmission of these variants of the virus and the propensity for the viruses to continue mutating in other nations. And if it means that we need to start taking a different approach to helping other countries, even if it's just through the lens of serving ourselves, national defense, global aid in this case is part of our national defense strategy against this virus, in my opinion. And that, you know, framing it in that type of way might be an appropriate way to really amp up the amount of resources that a government like the United States government is willing to throw at this pandemic abroad. Because as we just heard, as long as this virus is transmitting anywhere, we are really at risk for new variants to come around. And I think that it is probably one of the greatest threats that we should at least expect, but hope that it doesn't ever arise, but we should be planning for it. We should be doing everything in our power right now to assume that the worst will arise, because we've seen what happens when we don't plan accordingly. And we want to make sure that the last year doesn't continue happening across the globe again, and we continue on this beneficial streak that we're on, rather than going back in time and dealing with brand new epidemics within the current epidemic, if you will.
Thank you for those opening insights to everybody. I'm hearing a lot of themes from all of you about the importance right now in addressing the inequities around the globe and the challenges. We're gonna have a chance now to dig deeper. I wanna remind everyone who's tuning in that this is the forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We're presenting this jointly with The World from PRX and GBH. And the event is part of the Lawrence H. and Roberta Cohn Forum Series. Viewers, you can post your questions for all of the panelists here at the forum at hsph.harvard.edu. To kick off this next part, I wanna start with another audiogram from The World at PRX and GBH. This one is about technology transfer. It's something, Barry, that you started off referencing, and it's about vaccine manufacturing in Africa. You'll hear the voices of my colleague, reporter Halima Gikandi, and Patrick Tipu of the African Vaccine Manufacturing Initiative.
Patrick Tipu is with the African Vaccine Manufacturing Initiative. He says technology transfer could make a big difference here in Africa.
This allows you to partner with a mature vaccine manufacturer who's been there and done that. And it's the fastest way in which you as an African vaccine manufacturing company can scale up.
According to the WHO, there are fewer than 10 vaccine manufacturers on the continent, and most of them are not producing the active substance for these vaccines. Tipu says that African countries should aim to produce vaccines from beginning to end.
It's important for national security and health security purposes, as demonstrated by our current experience with COVID-19.
So these issues of technology transfer, building public health infrastructure in middle, low-income countries are so important now and preventing future catastrophes. Many of these places have a deep desire and resources too to make drugs and potentially vaccines. But Barry, I wanted to ask you first, why is this building up of manufacturing capacity, for example, in lower resource settings, so difficult, but also so important?
The challenge has been, how do you start from scratch to become a Pfizer or a J&J? What I'm hearing from my colleagues in South Africa particularly, is they have a lot of the scientific expertise that would be required to maintain the production analytical stuff in organizing and maintaining quality in a production facility. But to do that would require two things: external money to buy the heavy equipment and train people in how to use it. And the second is to be able to be sure that they have a market so that when they produce a vaccine, it's easy for COVID, because with 2% or 3% of poor countries vaccinated, we know what the market is. We need advanced market commitments from rich countries to make those available. But I think the long-term interest of my colleagues in Africa is not to be dependent on Western-produced vaccines that are only available under the conditions that the companies would like to have, but would like to have the capability of making their own vaccines against something, for example, like Lassa fever or Ebola, which is of no commercial interest to major companies, but given the technology, could be produced locally that would have a powerful impact. And so the question is, how can the rich countries collaborate, technology transfer, train, and help plan for an indigenous vaccine capability, not just against COVID, but to leave a residue from COVID for other African vaccines of interest that may not be of great commercial interest outside?
Nina, I wonder if you might be able to add to that also in terms of what you're seeing in terms of how that is moving along, how those, this has been a conversation for many, many months and prior to this pandemic. What are you seeing as being needed? And also, how are some of these transfers going right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I think that COVID has really changed the conversation, which I think is really important. So before it was like, oh, we got you, don't worry, we only need a certain number. I mean, Gavi has this thing called the supply and procurement strategy. It's excellent. You know, so we only need us, we don't need too many manufacturers because we don't want to flood the market and all that. So I think, you know, we don't need manufacturers in every country. These are expensive things that produce volume and they get scale and good prices at volume. But maybe we were a little bit too limited in how we saw what was the sort of optimal number of suppliers. So I think it's pushed the conversation, which is good, and also pushed it to say we need, as Barry said, we need manufacturing capacity where disease outbreaks happen at the end of the day. Now, you know, we have to also watch that if you put a factory or manufacturing capacity in country X, that country doesn't also make it a national product. So there are issues around how do we think about global public goods and make sure people share. But you know, there's two things I want to add specifically to what. So I think it's good that we're pushing the conversation on what is enough supply, where should supply be located, and who should have access to that supply, particularly in a pandemic. There's two things kind of missed that I think people have. One is that innovators are only Pfizer and Moderna. You know, we have Chinese innovators, we have Russian innovators, we have Indian companies are also innovating. We have a number of companies that have applied to CEPI, which is one of the partners in COVAX from India, that have innovator products for COVID-19 vaccines. And I think if we really want to think out of the box, this idea of tech transfer or partnership should be at the get-go in terms of when we contract and supply with people. So yes, we'll supply with you as a global purchaser, as a global public good, but only if you've pre-thought this out and actually can demonstrate to us that your partnerships are in place. And I think that's just good development. And then finally on that, something that Barry has mentioned as well is, you know, this isn't, we say in vaccines like fill finish. So basically we make it here, we send it there, they fill it and they finish it. It's pretty simple. Terminology is pretty clear in that point. And it's really also thinking in the long-term game about this has to start way up the biomedical sciences chain. And we have to make sure that there's genomic sequencing, all the things that we need to deal with a virus should be in every region of the world.
I want to ask Derek, just building on this conversation about working with vaccine manufacturers, developers, and makers, has that conversation been entering in earlier, or is that shifted from the beginning?
Yeah, I would agree with Nina there. I think the conversation has shifted. I think COVID-19 has really sort of proven the principle on a number of levels. I think firstly, there have been a number of innovator companies where they have thought about the technical transfer, as well as the scale out of their secondary production, and indeed even the primary production of the antigen at an early enough stage. So examples of this would include, for instance, the Oxford developed, you know, an AstraZeneca vaccine for which there has been a considerable amount of tech transfer across different parts of the world. A more recent example would be Novavax, which reported really encouraging results today. Novavax as well entered a development partnership together with CEPI, but with the network of CEPI, Gavi, ourselves, and together with the Serum Institute of India, embarked on a tech transfer program that started quite early on, not just on the fill finishes in ENA, but even further upstream into primary production or the antigen production as well. And I think those serve as good examples of what could be possible. And certainly we hope, as Nina said, that this catalyzes, right, further action and investment in this area. As Barry said, you know, it has taken some time, I think, for industry and stakeholders to kind of come around to the fact that this is possible and indeed desirable. And we hope that the conversation moves on, particularly now with, you know, well, they're more than concepts, right? So it's more than just proof of concept. We're actually seeing this live and happening.
I wanted to just follow up with you. You had mentioned in the beginning that COVAX so far has distributed, I think you said 86 million vaccines around the globe. And that's pretty short of what it had initially anticipated by this time. And we're hearing now of commitments from G7 countries, the US. But I wonder, first, is this slower than you had anticipated? And what do you see as factors of changing that and moving the needle right now?
Right. So indeed, we would have hoped that by this time that perhaps more doses would have been distributed to the participating countries. And as I said, I think we have actually contracted for, you know, in excess of about 2.8 billion doses. However, a number of factors have come into play. Firstly, a couple of manufacturers have faced delays in some of their scale up and production chains. We have also seen some delays on the regulator side. And I think this comes back to Barry's earlier comment about the need for an ecosystem to support. So for instance, we've seen batch release delays because some regulators have not had to deal with such a volume of batches, you know, coming through, and there's something around capacity. And we've certainly seen as well certain disruptions in supply chains, either in raw materials or in the actual vaccines themselves, because of pressing, you know, domestic or other needs, which has then prevented the export of these critical materials or the actual vaccines themselves. Some of these are certainly part and parcel of, you know, just normal scale up and vaccine development processes. And COVAX is certainly not the only entity that has seen, you know, delays. We've certainly seen certain delays in other parts of the world and other countries as well, particularly in the early phases. However, you know, moving forwards, what we expect is that we should see a catch up, because we will have some of these issues either normalize and start to resolve. We also expect to see other new manufacturers come increasing their supply and come on stream, and that will help the situation. And then you've brought up the important concept of dose sharing, as the G7 had announced in Cornwall over the weekend. The concept really there is that in the short term, most of the vaccine supply has already been contracted either by COVAX or other governments around the world. We do know that a number of countries probably have contracted more doses than they will probably need. And that's probably good news, because, you know, they were able to reach coverages much earlier on, and perhaps some of their supplies came through when they perhaps expected, you know, delays or attrition with some of their candidates. So what this means is that there is available supply that has been contracted that can be shared. And we are hopeful that with those announcements, most of those doses will be able to be shared equitably through the COVAX facility, through the allocation mechanism. So we're hoping that as we see those doses come through later this year, and some of the doses will come early next year, that will help to provide another avenue for vaccines to come through for the participants.
I want to get back to you in just a moment about this notion of how then you allocate and distribute and work on the supply that is available, a limited supply, most effectively. But Michael, I'm wondering, as you hear about the logistics and the challenges and the hopeful turns in vaccine production as one example, as an epidemiologist who's also following the variants and what's happening, what's going through your mind in terms of the timelines for this and also the kind of approaching tensions we might be seeing domestically versus globally?
I think while the speed of getting these vaccines out has been truly remarkable relative to how vaccines are normally developed and distributed, we are facing this race. And most of the vaccines, if not all of the vaccines, with a few small exceptions, are focused entirely on sort of version one of this virus, actually pre-alpha, you know, the very first virus that was first sequenced. And what that means is that today we're now projecting out getting the world vaccinated over the coming year, and that's, you know, if we have most people in the world vaccinated by the end of next year, you know, that would be a remarkable accomplishment. But we have to also be continually updating how we're thinking about this, how we're producing the vaccines. What happens if we have to start over? And what I mean by that is, what happens if it turns out that the Delta variant or whatever next variant is coming down the pipeline on the evolutionary train that this virus is on starts to break through immunity in the elderly people, for example? So we know that elderly people don't keep as strong an immune response in general. And so if in a place like the United States or in high-income countries in Europe, we start to see that the elderly start to have breakthrough cases of a new variant, just because their immunity drive from the initial vaccine is now a year old and they're starting to wane a bit. Do we then ethically start giving them a third dose of a vaccine when most of the world still remains unvaccinated? And in particular, what then happens if we start developing whole new vaccines that are targeting updated versions of this virus? Do we start giving people who have no vaccination in their arm yet, do we give them the new doses with the new sequences encoded in them? Or do we give them the old versions and give the wealthy countries the new versions to keep them updated? Now, I think that these are going to be exceptionally difficult questions that need to be asked now. I think we should absolutely be developing the plan for it now. What is the threshold at which the United States or another wealthy country says, actually, we're no longer going to divert these to developing countries because we want to get as many people above the age of 65 revaccinated? Is that on the table for us? And if so, what's the threshold that we're putting in place to make that decision? Hmm. I think that, you know, there's only so many ways that this pandemic is going to play out. And at this point in time, we should have a roadmap for pretty much every one of those directions, at least as many as we can imagine. We have the resources to develop the roadmaps. And that should mean that we almost can take an almost deterministic stance. As things progress in the future, we should be able to be 5 or 10 steps ahead to say, okay, this is what we're seeing now. This is what we are going to do with our vaccine allocation today and in 6 months or 1 year from now, given these checkpoints. So far, I haven't really seen that. We continue at this point in the pandemic to sort of fly by the seat of our pants, make decisions on a near daily basis with the CDC and other public health agencies about what our next plan is. And that's been quite disheartening as a public health expert and epidemiologist, knowing that so much of what has taken shape over the course of the year, we could have predicted, you know, 3 years ago, with the exception maybe of just how good the vaccines turned out to be. I think that truly did exceed all of our expectations, but that's a good problem to have. You know, we shouldn't be surprised anymore by what this virus is doing. And I worry that we continue being surprised. And I hope that we start asking a different sort of philosophical question of why are we continuing to be surprised when the knowledge is there? It was there before this virus was ever discovered. And I do hope that we start using that type of preemptive thinking to determine how we start allocating resources, including, and maybe most importantly, the vaccine distribution in the next year or so.
We have so many questions coming in, and I'm going to get to these in just a moment. But right now, we have questions about variants and the vaccines. Do all the vaccines work well against these variants well enough? And should to what degree is the priority then in this race, in this moment, getting as many people vaccinated as possible? And to what degree is this preparing for this other scenarios?
Yeah, so most of the vaccines that we have currently, they seem to be effective at preventing severe disease with the variants, which is absolutely crucial. How well they're each performing to limit spread of each of the new variants is a little bit difficult to say. We know that we have seen so far with the Alpha variants, for example, the UK variant, if you will, we know that it seems to be reducing spread quite a bit. We see similar evidence forming for each of them, which makes sense. If you have a vaccine that biologically is limiting severe disease, then that means it's naturally going to likely limit the growth of the virus in the body and therefore have some impact anyway on transmission. So we are seeing that each of the vaccines so far that we have good data for do appear to be working well. But as I mentioned a few moments ago, we also have to be expecting, you know, hoping for the best, but I think we should really be expecting that one day we will see a variant that, you know, where some of the top vaccines only have a 60% efficacy against. And what do we do in that situation? We haven't seen it yet, but we're seeing close to it with some of the vaccines. They were already starting at a lower efficacy than the mRNA vaccines, for instance. And that was with the original variant that they targeted directly. And now we're seeing that with each new iteration, each new variant, and now each new Greek alphabet letter into the alphabet there, we are seeing a slight decline in site decline and neutralizing capacity. Novavax and J&J and other vaccines. So J&J just came out with an announcement showing that their vaccine continues to work well, especially with T cells, against the new variants. That's absolutely crucial, but we should really place that in context. It's not working as well against a new variant set, but it's still working pretty well. And if we're focusing, for example, on T cells, then we're not necessarily focusing on a massive reduction in transmission. So we have to really, it's a very nuanced discussion. And I would just say that we have to assume with everything that we have that this virus is going to keep on its march away from our immunity. And that means the race is on. We have to continue figuring out and have the plan. And if the plan is best, if from an epidemiological and public health perspective, it's best to give everyone one dose as quickly as possible and then go back and redose them again with their second dose, then maybe that's the plan we should really be focusing on if speed is of the essence and access to the vaccines, you know, is the limiting feature. I still don't think we've taken sort of the most optimal public health approaches to this. And I think the variants just are applying more and more pressure to us to really think from a greater sort of optimization standpoint of how we truly get the greatest number of people protected to limit spread the most. And I think we're struggling with this difference between public health optimization versus individual level medicine optimization. Mm.
I want to transition from that into a question I had already, but also has come in from Samit to Derek. And Nina, I'd also be curious about you weighing in, and Barry too, which is what support can we provide to healthcare workers operating in under-resourced remote areas of the globe? And I want to build on that in terms of vaccine supply. I mean, there is a limited supply. So how are you looking at how you prioritize that and what sort of approach you're taking, or is that evolving to maximize exactly what Michael's talking about? That wasn't fair. That was two questions. Sorry.
The important thing is that we need to protect the frontline workers and the healthcare workers. We have seen the devastating impact of what happens when healthcare systems are not adequately prepared and where healthcare workers, as our frontline workers, are not adequately protected. And that has been paramount. So in the prioritization and the targets that we have set at COVAX, we have been looking at the prioritization of the frontline workers, which includes the healthcare workers, and the most vulnerable persons. And these individuals comprise approximately 20% of the population of each country and economy, and that is the target that we have set initially to ensure that countries are able to access at least 20% enough vaccines to cover at least 20% of their populations to meet those objectives. I think what's increasingly important, and I'm sure Nina will expand on this, is around the delivery infrastructure. And that is really vitally important, because then to equip our healthcare workers to do their work, there needs to be investment in training, in cold chain facilities, in just equipment for them to do their work, protective equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And those sort of things are where I think we need to put further attention. And certainly we're working with a number of partners to see how we can further support that. But that, I think, remains an area. You know, we've been focusing on the vaccines, focusing on getting them out there, but we need to make sure that it's end to end, and that actually the vaccines are able to reach, the arms of people who need them the most. And that whole delivery and administration support is something that we need to look at as well.
So in the way that COVAX is prioritizing in an equitable way, this goal of 20% of a population, getting it to people who need it most. Nina, how do you see that conversation? Who are the people that need it most, if we're saying, and how does that get distributed? And Derek, feel free to weigh in too, because I'm really curious and interested in how that conversation is staying the same, or if it's evolving too, given now what we've seen in certain regions that have experienced massive outbreaks, or what we know more about different populations.
Yeah, I think that conversation has to evolve massively. And I just actually looked up the allocation thing for COVAX, which I think was last published last fall, is the last one online on the site. I mean, who's most at risk? So we vaccinate healthcare workers in part because they were at risk because of close contact, obviously. And the other reason is because we need healthcare workers. We can't afford them in the midst of a pandemic to have them be out of work. So there's a bunch of really rational reasons to go for healthcare workers first. But in terms of who's most at risk, I mean, I think we massively ignored the syndemic of non-communicable diseases and COVID. So countries that have huge prevalence of obesity and diabetes, for example, are countries that have been massively hit, and populations that have been massively hit by severe COVID. And I don't see that happening anywhere. There's a lot of discussion about, we got to get, give our doses. And the discussion ends at port of entry. Like, okay, we've delivered them there. They're at the airport. See ya. And what Derek said is absolutely right. First is, are the systems there to deliver them? And I don't just mean, again, the cold chain systems. That's one part of the human resource systems. And you showed that video from India. And my first thought was, I hope those people also talked about the other health needs of they were visiting, and they didn't just come with the COVAX vaccine and leave. I'm sure there's a wide sort of neglected panoply of public health needs of that group. So I really think, I just passionately think, and I see how this evolved in our own neighborhood at District 1 in New York City. I live in a rather, in a diverse neighborhood in New York City. It wasn't the elderly people with diabetes and hypertension and heart disease or kidney that were first in line for that vaccine. And from what we see and hear from around the world, those conversations just are not happening. Parliamentarians, yes. People on kidney dialysis who also exist in low and middle income countries, sort of not happening. So it's really time to push the conversation to that level.
Barry, I wanted to ask you, bringing into this conversation, Michael had mentioned about maybe the issue too right now is wondering about if we're looking at speed about single doses and spreading those doses that are available further. And I wonder, what do you think of this idea of that? And we have a question that also came in building on that, like about boosters and whether you see that as being something that will be needed, and if so, when?
So I'm a big fan of optimizing immune responses for exactly the reasons that Michael has indicated. It is absolutely now clear that booster shots for many of the vaccines both increase the amount of antibodies that neutralize the virus, increase the duration of production of antibodies, and in essence, optimize the ability of an individual to diversify their immune response by a booster shot to see more determinants and a stronger immune response. And as you'll remember, there have been great discussions about spreading out the doses of vaccines, of giving people one dose, and someday maybe we'll come back and give a second dose. I think the immunological data say if you want to protect people, particularly against variants, optimize their ability to produce the strongest immune response they can. And that's within the range of what the companies have proposed for those vaccines that are primary immunization and booster shots within a reasonable period of time.
This question comes from Katrina, kind of dialing back a little bit to this moment. Derek, I wonder if you can weigh in on this, and Michael too. What are your thoughts on this Nova vaccine? I mean, in what way or to what degree will it help the lack of vaccines in some parts of the world? And I wonder if that's may build on other vaccines we might anticipate seeing too. I know, and also Nina, you mentioned, you know, we have now the WHO has approved the several vaccines from China as well, as the pool is expanding.
Yeah, I think the important thing is that we're seeing a range of vaccines reaching the final stages of the development and starting to report out, you know, encouraging results in the main. And there's obviously a number of steps to go. You know, they still have to meet regulatory criteria. And then beyond that, the ability to produce at scale. Let's not forget that there are a large number of innovator companies that are developing a vaccine and bringing it to the market for the very first time. And perhaps all of the manufacturers are producing vaccines at a scale in a compressed timeframe that we have not seen before, you know, sort of churning out billions of doses within, you know, a quarter or 6 months of their licensure. So this requires a whole lot of technical expertise, experience, as well as planning. And so I think, you know, very encouraging to see these vaccines reach those stages of licensure. You know, we want them to be able to scale up as well to increase that accessibility. I think the other element is how can the supply chains also scale out? And this comes back to the earlier conversation. What is encouraging to see, as I mentioned earlier, is that a number of these you know, innovator companies are looking at partnerships across the globe to be able to increase their reach. I think that becomes vitally important. And it's not just, I think, for this year, but, you know, we want to see those partnerships become more robust and more sustainable over time, because as Michael and Barry said, you know, there may be need for this vaccine, you know, whether it's in terms of boosters or other adapted, you know, vaccines that may come after that for some time yet. So we do need, you know, keep a view on the future as to how this is not just a short-term goal, but this is something that we need to ensure sustainability in terms of the accessibility, access, and affordability of these vaccines for all the individuals who need them.
I might have missed this, but and you may or may not be able to weigh into this level. So with a company like Novavax and their plan, do you see those conversations about building those agreements with other places to build that capacity in the partner agreements?
Yeah, I think certainly in the specific case of Novavax, they do have a partnership with the Serum Institute of India, which is the largest volume vaccine producer in the world. There's certainly, you know, work that they have been collaborating on for many months now. And certainly at COVAX, we do have agreements in place with both Novavax and the Serum Institute of India for this particular candidate vaccine, should it be successful in its licensure. So certainly those discussions have been ones that COVAX have been having with both of those institutions. And we're certainly looking forward to, you know, access to those vaccines as soon as they become licensed and available.
Michael, what's your reaction to some of the, obviously Novavax hasn't gotten clearance, official clearance yet, but I see the bigger picture of like, this is not the end of it here, but what what kind of signs or what do you see with something like these promising waves of something like Novavax being a vaccine that seems to be really effective right now?
I think one of the nice pieces, one of the nice parts of the Novavax story is that it's a different type of vaccine. It uses different technologies, comes from different supply chains. And that, I think, you know, has been a story of this entire pandemic, is try to diversify your supply chains. And Novavax is doing that. I think that that particular vaccine, actually most of the vaccines, well, the mRNA vaccines in particular and Novavax, they're each well-poised in terms of their technology to be multivalent, which means to not encode just a single protein like we have seen so far, but to actually encode multiple proteins in a way that hasn't always traditionally been done with vaccines. Of course, we have seen multi-pronged vaccines like flu, for example. But that's something that excites me about the potential for a Novavax vaccine, which is, just to describe it, it's essentially a nanoparticle with little proteins built out onto it and an internal adjuvant to sort of stimulate the immune response. And so I like it because it's a different technology, and I'm excited to see sort of where it goes, how well it continues to perform. And they've said that they can scale up quite a bit. I think the last I read was that they, by the end of this particular, this year, they're hoping to achieve 100 million doses a month, which for a country, for a company that's really just starting out with its first potential licensed vaccine or authorized vaccine in this case, that's a pretty big accomplishment. It's ambitious. And, you know, if they can carry through with that, I think that it will add a tremendous amount of doses, of needed doses, and ideally in a vaccine that can be malleable to adjust to new variants in the future.
We have time for just one more question, if it's okay, if you're okay with us running just a couple minutes over. I think given this whole theme of this discussion has been around vaccine distribution globally with variants, access, this question's from Regina, and I want to ask this to Nina. If you were at the G7 summit, which kind of captures some of the major countries that have access to or have developed or have the lion's share of these vaccines currently, what is the most important thing you would want to say to leaders about the pandemic right now? No pressure.
Pressure. I mean, that's a really hard question. I think one is that it's not over. There are many broken parts to the system. As Michael said, this is not the last pandemic we're going to see, and we need to use this opportunity both to address what we have here and now in front of us, but also the issues that Barry has talked about this is a medium and long-term game about pandemic preparedness, and the system in place is not the right one. There are discussions we haven't talked about, a treaty or who should handle pandemic preparedness. Is there enough financing? So this is a big story, and it didn't end this weekend.
Mm-hmm. I want to take this opportunity now to ask all of you to provide a final takeaway from this discussion. And maybe we can start backwards with going from Michael to Derek to Nina to Barry, and to wrap up what the different threads that are connected in so many important ways in this discussion.
Yeah, well, I have two. The first is that to remember that a novel virus does not mean we know nothing about it at the outset. I think it's important that to recognize now that we can start planning today for the next pandemic. We don't know what that pandemic is going to be, but it will not be fully novel. It might be a new virus, but it will still play by many of the same rules that we're learning about in this pandemic and that we've known about for a long time. The other bit is, as part of that planning, this past year or this year is showing us that, you know, we had all of last year to start planning for the issues that we're hearing from Derek and Nina about, you know, all of the things that have nothing to do with the human biological system to get these vaccines out. These are things that we can start putting in place today for the next pandemic, you know, even before any biology is known, is specifically known for that particular virus, whatever it might be. And I just hope that we use this. I don't want to see us come out of this pandemic and not learn these crucial features that are going to help our future selves. But I worry that as humans, we have a pretty great propensity and capacity to quickly move forward and forget about things that just recently happened. And I hope that we do not. do that here.
Thank you. Derek?
I think for me, it's about the, you know, the fact that no country is an island, so to speak. And I think, you know, self-interest is global interest, you know, because with no individual state can purely hope to find a solution without contributing in some way to the global solution. And I think this pandemic has you know, demonstrated that and continues to. And I think that's the lesson that I hope that all, you know, all states and players will bear in mind and take that forward as we plan for, you know, resolving this pandemic and then looking to the future as well, as Michael said.
Yeah, I'd like to echo what both Michael and Derek have said, but really, we knew 8 months ago, as soon as we heard that. I mean, I think in the beginning we thought vaccine in 6 months, never going to happen. And then it was clear by the fall it was actually happening, and all of this planning could have been done in advance. We know how to micro plan. We've gotten polio to the ends of the most remote places in the world, and we could have planned, engaged communities, planned, got rosters in place. This was all could have, a lot of this could have been planned for. And that's a lesson that, I mean, and we should be doing that now still. So we can't forget the last mile as we focus on the upstream issues, vaccine development and deployment. We could call it vaccines and vaccination. It's an end-to-end spectrum from the lab, you know, all the way to the family.
Thank you. Barry, back to you.
Look, I've spent my life as a teacher. I taught the first course in immunology in India in 1968. And now, no thanks to me, I'm sure, India has the largest vaccine production capacity in the world. The opportunity for not just technology transfer, but scientific knowledge transfer to countries in Africa that are hungering to be able to use their educations, to be able to do things for their countries. This is an opportunity for partnerships, for training, for technology transfer, scientific transfer, and partnerships, as Derek said, that will exist long beyond COVID and provide a base for the autonomy of countries to set their own scientific and medical priorities.
That was Barry Bloom, former dean of Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Joan L. and Julius H. Jacobson Research Professor of Public Health. Nina Schwalbe, CEO of Spark Street Advisors, a think tank that's provided support to the World Health Organization and other agencies during the pandemic. Derek Sim, Director of Vaccine Supply and Demand at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. And Michael Minna, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. It was also part of the Dr. Lawrence H. and Roberta Cohn Forum series. You can view the video of this conversation at our Facebook page. You can find that at theworld.org/Facebook and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.
From PRX.